good evening. This most unusual and important race for the White House at the finish line.
The results tonight have been phenomenal.
Your patience is commendable. We knew this was going to go wrong.
What the President of the United States is saying, in large part, is absolutely untrue.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're watching The Listening Post, working from home. For the American media, election night coverage just drags on and on. Their predictions were off, but their reporting on the vote count and the aftermath has been far better. It's called Neo-Ottoman Cool. Turkey is exporting its history through epic TV adventures from the days of empire. India, the arrest of Arnab Goswami, one of the country's loudest pro-government voices on television. Then, it's back to the U.S.
I will go down with this ship.
And the sinking ship that is the Trumptanic. Journalists knew that the coverage of election night in America was going to turn into a waiting game. The pandemic and all that mail-in voting meant that the results would take time. What they didn't have a feel for was how much time, since the race turned out to be much closer than expected. Once again, the polls, which predicted that Joe Biden's Democratic Party would win, maybe even in a landslide, were way off. We'll get into some of the reasons why that happened. What was predicted correctly was that this president would not go down easily, that Donald Trump would contest the results, suggest the election was stolen, maybe even declare victory. For that, the media came prepared and pushed back hard, even the Trump-backing Fox News Channel. But with the Biden victory, all those news networks and media outlets that have thrived on the Trump show should get thinking about a new business model. Our starting point this week is Washington, D.C.
A very tense nation still waiting tonight to learn who will be the next president.
When the polls closed and the election broadcasts went live, the anchors, analysts, and pundits had no idea how long it would take, the ride they were in for, and just how chaotic Donald Trump would make it.
We are a United States of anxiety at the moment.
All of them knew that there were moments coming, testing ones, and they had to have a plan on how to handle them, how to cover those moments.
We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
The first came on election night at 2:28 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Axios reported earlier in the day that the president was going to try to declare victory no matter what happened that night. And again, we all kind of sat there and watched, like, you know, you can't turn your eyes away from a car crash. And, you know, we're still learning on the last possible day of voting that, you know, maybe airing everything that he says is not a great idea.
NBC and MSNBC dumped out of his remarks to come to the viewers and say, this isn't true.
We are reluctant to step in, but duty-bound to point out when he says we did win this election, we've already won, that is not based in the facts at all.
MSNBC didn't even go back to him. You saw Nora O'Donnell, the chief anchor for CBS, saying that the president was castrating the facts.
Falsely claiming that he has won the election.
You saw some impressive pushback on CNN.
My jaw dropped when I heard the president of the United States say, we should stop all voting.
On Fox News, Brett Baier said, well, the president said a lot of things that were accurate, but he then turned to Chris Wallace, and Chris Wallace said, you know,
this is an extremely flammable situation, and the president just threw a match into it.
And that's Fox News, the network that's been President Trump's biggest, most important backer on the American airwaves. Roughly 48 hours later, Trump was back at it, sounding off with zero evidence on election fraud and taking a swipe at the polls that for the second straight election have proven inaccurate by severely underestimating the Trump vote.
These really phony polls, I have to call them phony polls, fake polls, were designed to keep our voters at home, create the illusion of momentum for Mr. Biden and diminish Republicans' ability to raise funds. They were what's called suppression polls. Everyone knows that now.
Okay, here we are again in the unusual position of not only interrupting the President of the United States, but correcting the President of the United States.
The polls, some of which were taken by conservative agencies, were not phony or fake. They were flawed. Most are conducted over mobile phone networks, making the slice of the population that doesn't use mobiles, like the elderly, or that can't afford them, hard to reach, harder to measure. Plus, there's the shy Trumper theory on whether pollsters are getting straight answers from respondents. Still, media organizations find polls irresistible. They provide cheap news content, number-driven talking points that 19 times out of 20, pundits and prognosticators pour out in the form of horse race journalism.
Our final NBC News Wall Street Journal poll completed overnight shows Joe Biden leading President Trump by 10 points.
All that news coverage of polls during the campaign emphasized an area of reporting that has proven once again to be defective.
In 2016, they were like, well, we made a mistake because of shy Trumpers or because of this, because of that, because people didn't want to admit they wanted to vote for Trump. In 2020, they made mistakes on Senate races. They got it wrong in the Senate, like big time. And I don't know if it's telephones or what, but the biggest loser in the 2020 election is polling, right? It's wrong for us in the media to rely on polls. We have now seen that this is not a science, that this doesn't work anymore.
Well, we had thought that the polling fraternity had learned some lessons, and there was much talk the last few years about tweaking their polls. One of the tweaks supposedly was to make sure that a larger component of non-college educated white males were included, because there was a belief that the initial polling had undercounted them and that they were a key factor in Trump defeating Hillary Clinton. And the assumption was this time they had it right. Clearly, they did not have it totally right.
I saw someone tweeting yesterday, like, oh, if Trump wins again, like the polling industry is dead. And that's like saying, you know, if climate change is real, then the oil industry is dead. Polling is an integral part of this whole dog and pony show, this whole circus that we're part of. I think part of it is American culture. We're very impatient. We want to know information right away, even if we know that our sources might not have all of the information. We just want to be able to point to something and say, look at this and look at what's happening here.
Part of that show is the journalists need to be first, and presidential election nights bring out the competitor in them. The networks want their prediction desks to declare the winners state by state before other news channels do.
Presidential election with several states too close to call, millions of ballots left to be counted.
This time around, with the pandemic boosting postal voting and extending the counting process, and with the president accusing the fake news media of trying to steal the election, American news outlets resisted their usual need for speed.
There's been a lot more caution about vote counting. It's a different election than it's ever been for America because we have this terrible pandemic, and we knew there were going to be tons of mail-in numbers.
Of course, the winner of this presidency has not been determined, with millions of those legitimate votes still to be counted.
A lot of the entities that called the elections were really, really careful, and that was really great.
The networks have been burned often, and their caution is now predictable and fairly admirable, but election nights still show the modern media's tension between speed on one hand and getting it right on the other.
Now, many people like things fast, but we're not talking about a Wi-Fi connection here. We're talking about our democracy.
One sees it every day, obviously, in media, often to the detriment of good journalism. But by and large, this time on this election, caution has ruled.
Donald Trump has made it clear if he's going down, he's going down swinging. His only remaining path to re-election is through the courts. The cases will drag on, minus the evidence that Trump needs to win. So will the briefings in front of the journalists he calls enemies of the people. The sound bites, the bombast, the circus that has defined American politics for 4 years will keep eyeballs glued and ratings up until January at least. But the news networks and their accountants must be asking themselves, what's next?
It is likely that you would see sort of stagnant or declining ratings from the cable networks, notably MSNBC and CNN, who have been very high-profile Trump detractors, in part because Joe Biden is just not going to be as sexy and newsy and as bombastic and as controversial and as antagonistic is Donald Trump. So it's one of the ironies is that Fox probably benefits because it can probably morph from being conduit and handmaiden for and of Donald Trump to being now the opposition to the Democratic president, Joe Biden.
For Fox, it'll be an easy enough pivot to really trash the Bidens, to trash the press for not destroying the Bidens, and to go after Harris and just see what kind of mischief they can make, connecting the administration to BLM or Antifa or anything else that seems to be at variance with the vision of America they claim to embrace. So I don't think it's that tough a game plan for Fox.
Fox News and many American news outlets will forever be stained by the sycophantic role they played in Donald Trump's rise. But here's the irony. Since taking office, by lowering the standards of political discourse, bottoming out, this president has inadvertently managed to raise the standards of American political reporting at his own expense. Donald Trump isn't the only national leader who lies. But name one other country where the majority of news outlets, responsible ones, will cut the mic and just call it what it is.
Undemocratic and false.
That's quite the legacy, if not the one Donald Trump was looking for. Moving on now from a country that's been known to call itself the world's greatest democracy to the one that touts itself as the world's largest, India. And the squeeze on editorial freedoms and freedom of expression there, ever since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP came to power back in 2014. First up, on our radars, we have Nick Muirhead on a curious story involving one of India's most notorious television news hosts, Arnab Goswami, who was arrested this past week. Nick, tell us a little bit about Goswami, who he is, and the circumstances of this arrest.
Goswami is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Republic TV. He hosts a nightly show that focuses on politics, but frequently descends into screaming matches.
I really have felt so angry about it. How would a martyr's family feel today?
He is unashamedly pro-Modi and pro-BJP. Out of nowhere, this week, he was arrested in Mumbai in connection with a suicide that took place in 2018. According to the suicide note that this case is based on, Goswami allegedly owed the man who killed himself, owed him a large sum of money and was refusing to pay it back. Goswami has since denied that allegation.
But if this suicide case is 2 years old, why did the arrest only occur now?
Well, that's what much of the skepticism around this case is about. You see, when the suicide took place, the Indian state which Republic TV operates out of, Maharashtra, it was under the BJP government. Since then, there have been state elections and an opposition party has taken control. An opposition party that Goswami frequently takes aim at, often with claims that just don't stand up to journalistic scrutiny, which raises the concern that the state police are being used to settle political vendettas.
And have you been watching the coverage of this story on Republic TV?
Yes, on its Hindi and its English channel, both have been running basically on repeat the arrest video, which you can hear Goswami accuse the officers of assaulting him.
They're physically assaulted.
They're physically assaulted.
There have been a number of senior BJP ministers who have come out in support of Goswami, essentially saying that his arrest amounts to an attack on press freedom in the country, which is ironic because some of those same very ministers have been largely silent about and even complicit in the arrest and harassment of critics of the BJP government.
Okay, thanks, Nick. It's been on the air for 5 seasons now. There have been more than 400 episodes. And with hundreds of millions of viewers, Derelish Ertuğrul, or Ertuğrul's Resurrection, is one of Turkey's biggest television exports yet. And this is a country that's among the top exporters of TV content in the world. Derelish Ertuğrul is a historical epic. It's set in the 13th century. It's on the founding of the Ottoman Empire. The show cashes in on a wave of nostalgia and fascination for that era, what's known as Neo-Ottoman cool. But given the topic, the time period, and the current geopolitical context, there's a propagandistic feel to the show and others like it that plays right into the hands of Turkey's ruling party, the AKP, and President Erdogan's own brand of Turkish nationalism. The Listening Post's Meenakshi Ravi now on how history, politics, and entertainment collide in Turkey's Ottoman epics.
Every community,
every nation has a trove of key stories, alluring magnetic narratives that are retold time and again.
From the Elizabeth, Queen of England, Ireland, and France.
In Britain, there are stories of royalty, from the past to the present. In Korean popular culture, the campaign for independence from Japan is a recurrent theme.
Osmanlı'nın yeni topraklar keşfetmekteki arzusu, ilahi kelimetullah inancımızdan feyz almaktadır.
And in Turkey, over the past decade or so, Ottoman history, the opulence, conquests, power, has been one of the most popular storylines across media, but especially on TV.
Turkey is a society in constant change, a society in constant flux. And in such countries, in times of crisis especially, history emerges as a cement, which plays a significant role in creation of identities. The rising interest in Ottoman stories, Ottoman past, in terms of TV dramas, has been a really, really important phenomena.
Ottoman-themed shows were not popular up to a point. In fact, the most popular shows were romantic dramas.
Ben Süleyman.
And then suddenly, around 2011, Magnificent Century or Muhteşem Yüzyıl became a big hit. That has been a catalyst for this change, and we're seeing more of the Ottoman-related, Ottoman-inspired shows in Turkish television.
Magnificent Century was an unqualified success, an international hit, watched by tens of millions across the Middle East, Asia, and Latin America. It put the country's TV industry and the dramas it produces, dizzies as they're called in Turkish, into the big leagues. That was back in 2011. 4 years later, Diriliş Ertuğrul, or Ertuğrul's Resurrection, came on the air, confirming the international appeal of dizzies and opening up new markets. In Pakistan, for instance,
agar hamari mulaqat na hui, to sabke liye mushkil ho jayegi bahut.
The series gets blockbuster ratings on PTV, the state broadcaster there.
The plot of Ertuğrul is centered around the founders of the Ottoman Empire.
Biz Türk'üz. İmdiye de korkmadık. İmdiden sonra da korkmayacağız.
Korkmayacağız! Telling stories about the founding of the Ottoman Empire. One aspect of the popularity of these series is that they show the Middle East, the Muslim cities at the center of the world, contrasting with portrayals of the West as weak and divided. In Ertuğrul, we see the defeat of the Crusaders. These themes of kind of Islamic pride definitely contribute to its popularity, and Pakistan is a good example of that.
Diriliş Ertuğrul being popular specifically in the Muslim world is fascinating by itself. Well, there are a couple of elements to look at why. The first one is cultural proximity. There's so much cultural overlap between Middle Eastern neighbors and Turkey. And also, after the success of Magnificent Century, fascination with everything that is related to the Ottoman Empire became very popular, and the consumption of that became cool.
Neo-Ottoman cool is a term that I and my colleague Marwan Kredi coined to reflect that new image of Turkey that started perhaps around 15 years ago. It demonstrated that shift of perception from Turkey as an enemy to Turkey as a model, and Turkish soft power was perhaps at its height with the rise of President Erdogan at the time, and this went hand in hand with the popularity of Turkish popular culture, particularly Turkish TV series.
For President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party, known as the AK Party in Turkey, reconnecting with the Ottoman era has been central to their messaging.
Kültürün her alanında birikimimizi sahiplenecek, değerlerimizi yaşatacak çalışmaları ön plana çıkarmalı ve desteklemeliyiz.
In his more than 15 years in power, Erdogan has pushed a notion of continuity, drawing a line from the Ottoman Sultans through to himself.
Türkiye Cumhuriyeti tıpkı daha önceki devletlerimizin birbirlerinin devamı olduğu gibi Osmanlı'nın devamıdır.
Erdogan has done that while locking up his critics in the news media, transforming Turkey into one of the world's leading jailers of journalists. Scores of academics and dissidents have been imprisoned as well. Amidst all of that, the TV dramas Dirilish Ertuğrul and a spin-off Payitaht Abdulhamid, both of which were commissioned by Turkey's state broadcaster TRT, have aligned nicely with the AKP's communication strategy.
Ottomanism and neo-Ottomanism has begun to be an influential domestic and international political instrument. And this has been further consolidated during the AKP era.
Allah için, devlet için, töre için yaşayacağız.
The whole plot of Diriliş Ertuğrul is a reenactment of contemporary Turkish politics. The people on the one hand, the enemies of the people on the other hand. The leader on the one hand, the enemies of the leader on the other hand.
Elements of the show, Diriliş Ertuğrul specifically, and also recently Payitaht Abdulhamid, have been used for pro-AKP and pro-Erdogan initiatives, especially the political rallies and campaigns. For example, in the presidential campaign in 2017, this video specifically demonstrates that there's a historical continuity between the Ottoman Empire and President Erdogan.
Bizim nefsimiz mesele değil. Meselemiz millettir, meselemiz vatandır.
For audiences cynical both of Erdogan and of Turkey's role in the region, the comparisons between Ottoman TV heroes and the Turkish president not only fall flat, they're seen as a not-so-subtle flexing of muscles, a signal that Turkey can, through its cultural exports, try to soften public sentiment that has undeniably hardened across a number of Arab nations, not least because of Turkey's role in two wars, in Syria and Libya.
These drama series take added importance because they are often interpreted by governments as part of that Turkish political and military push. And we can see kind of a counter historic interpretation in a number of new big budget series that are produced by Arab countries like the UAE and Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
الذين ما إن دخلوا بلدا إلا نهبوا ثرواتها وقتلوا علماءها واستعبدوا أهلها.
ممالك النار is one of the more recent examples. It takes up the Mamluk period as its backdrop and kind of shows in a very negative light the Turkish historic intervention in Egypt and some portrayals mock Turkish historical figures.
Ideological battles fought over the airwaves are not limited to news reporting or political rhetoric. Entertainment informs audiences. It too shapes hearts and minds. By tapping into a fascination for the Ottoman era, Turkish dizzies have grown into an export industry, a cultural weapon for a country out to resurrect its history, if not its empire.
And finally, the election story still unfolding in the U.S. has exposed once again the flaws in the polling. And it wasn't just journalists and politicos paying attention to those polls. So were comedians and the online satirical industry. This next video is from an account called Believe Me News. It imagines the president as the captain of a sinking ship, the Trumptanic. The track is from 2003 and the British singer Dido. It fits right into 2020, though, as an ode to Donald Trump's enablers in the Senate and some in the U.S. news media who are going down with the ship. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.
If the Republican Senate candidates get scared that Trump is dragging them down,
one of the wettest we've ever seen from the standpoint of water,
will they continue to cling to him if he's potentially plummeting to the bottom of the ocean?
Surrounded by water and big water, ocean water.
What is your understanding of why Republicans are doing this?
I think it's that same genetic impulse that pulls the lemmings over the cliff, one after the other.
And then we get conspiracy theories and we get lies. Where is the line? When are you guys going to say enough?
You have to take the children away.
Very fine people.
The Stormy Daniels deal.
That call was perfect.
A bunch of suckers.
You still stand there silent.
I will go down with this shit.
Why are you laughing?
Surrounded by water, big water, ocean water.